This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, January 24th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. In 2017, Immigration and Customs Enforcement reported that they removed more than 81,000 people from the United States. These are known as interior removals. And that number, 81,000, is a 37% increase from the year before. Under the Trump administration, ICE has been targeting people here illegally with criminal records who they say pose a threat to the United States. But some of the individuals being deported are immigrant activists and, in some cases, the public face of the fight over immigration in their own communities.
When are we going to be free? When is going to be the day that we don't have to have these panels, that we don't have to have people saying, stop my deportation, or I need to go on hunger strike for you to pay attention? When is going to be the day that we're going to care regardless of what people are going through?
Maru Moravillo-Pondo is an organizer with the Northwest Detention Center Resistance. She was placed in deportation proceedings after ICE ordered her to appear in court at the end of December.
So a lot of people in detention that's been in this country for 40 years, 43 years, been here, have families just like mine, being deported.
That's Jean Montreville. He's co-founder of the New Sanctuary Coalition of New York. He was arrested on January 3rd and deported to Haiti 13 days later.
If you allow people to go back in the shadows, it is only a matter of time when you will end up in the shadows. You do not want to be in the shadows. You don't want to be in the group that is always terrified of and looking over your shoulder and looking around your back as if someone is coming after you.
And that's Ravi Rogbeer from that same New Sanctuary Coalition of New York as Jean Montreville. Rogbeer is the executive director of that immigrant rights organization, and he recorded that message the day before he was detained on January 11th during a regular check-in with ICE. At the time, protests erupted right outside our windows here at WNYC and the Immigration Processing Center nearby. Police arrested 18 people on that day, including members of the New York City Council. We spoke with Ravi around this time last year on our show. It was the last days of the Barack Obama presidency, and Ravi at the time was holding out hope for a pardon.
Right now, I cannot plan anything further than 2 weeks ahead because I don't know what will happen. If you tell me, let's have a dinner in June, I will say, yes, I'll appreciate that, but get back to me closer to that time. That terror that I face is very tangible. And, you know, after the election, my wife, who is an immigration advocate, also an immigration attorney, she did not stop crying for 24 hours because she understood the impact it would have on me and the impact it will have on our lives.
Ravi Rogbeer's wife, Amy Gottlieb, is with me now. She's also an immigrant rights activist and an attorney, as Ravi just mentioned there. Amy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
What is Ravi's status now? He's from Trinidad, in detention as we understand it. What's the latest?
That's right. He is at the Orange County Jail in upstate New York, and we are challenging his detention and, of course, continuing to challenge his deportation. He does have a deportation order that was issued about 12 years ago based on a criminal conviction that he incurred back in like 2000. So many, many, many years ago, one-time conviction. And he has been fighting that deportation ever since.
We'll talk about that conviction and other factors that have led to Ravi's detention, Amy. His deportation order right now says what? When is he possibly going to be deported back to Trinidad?
Well, they wanted to deport him on January 11th, if not before, the day that he checked in. And because we got a stay of removal, they cannot deport him right now. But if that stay of removal is lifted, he could be deported any minute. So, you know, we're keeping careful track and really have an extraordinary team of lawyers and supporters who are working to prevent that deportation.
So, Amy Gottlieb, we heard in the intro there from other activists like Maru Moravillo-Pondo, Jean Montreville, of course, your husband, Ravi. Do you believe that they are being targeted because of their immigration activism?
I do. I can't believe otherwise. You know, we've seen 5 people in the last 2 weeks who are, you know, outspoken and working on immigrant rights issues being taken in or being told they're going to be taken in by ICE. So it's very hard to believe that there could be any other reason for these particular people to be brought in. I mean, we know that, you know, thousands of people every year are deported and they're not all immigrant rights activists, but it does seem very telling that in these last 2 weeks, there have been 5 at least who have been taken in.
And people representing the other activists who we mentioned, John Montreville, Maru Moravillapando, and others, I know that you've probably been in communication with them. Do they all believe that this is part of an organized targeting of immigration activists?
We do. And there's been, you know, quite a bit of news coverage looking at this kind of this trajectory of where we are. And it really does feel like it's an attempt by ICE to quiet or shut out the voices of people who have been willing to come out and say, wait a minute, our immigration policies are unfair and unjust and we need to challenge them. And it just seems like they want to, you know, quiet, you know, squash any dissent that's out there.
How did Ravi come to this country? What's the history of his immigration to the United States?
He came way back in the early 90s, like many people, you know, coming for opportunities. He ended up actually getting married to somebody else and staying here. He was a green card holder and has been, you know, working and living here ever since the early 90s. So it's a long time here where he's become, you know, an integral part of our communities, our society. He has, you know, we together, our families, our community, our friends are all here in New York.
Now, Ravi was convicted of wire fraud in 2001. You mentioned it. He went to prison, but that also, importantly here, changed his immigration status, right? It's the fact that Ravi has been convicted of a crime that, regardless of his status, I suppose, as an activist, certainly gives the legal pretext for his deportation.
Yes. Yeah, so the laws that were signed in 1996 by President Clinton actually allow ICE, or force ICE, really, to deport anybody who has pretty much any criminal conviction. And that's something that has been litigated now for years and years and years, but on an individual case-by-case basis. I mean, fundamentally, we need to change those laws, because what happens is, even if you're a green card holder, even if you have a mountain of equities next to you, that you've done only good in your life but for that one crime, the immigration court system is only allowed to look at that crime. They can't see the person for the person. They can only see you have this crime, so you're out of here. And so there is a lot of work being done to change that, but that's what Ravi is facing, that 1996 immigration law has basically made it impossible for the courts to look at him. And so he has been really fortunate. We've been really fortunate because we've had the opportunity. We're continuing to challenge this in the courts. And I think what's telling is that back in March, Ravi had a check-in with ICE back in March 9th, and he was not taken in that day. And nothing has changed in his legal procedures. That case remains pending. The same cases that were pending back in March are currently pending. So something shifted for ICE inside that made them say, okay, we're going to go after Gene Montreville on January 3rd, even though he also had a check-in scheduled and was fully intended to go in to that check-in. And the same for Ravi. You know, he's never said, I'm going to hide. I'm, you know, not going to be present for my required check-ins. And something shifted inside of ICE, and they said, okay, this is it. We're taking him in.
Well, ICE has released a statement. I want to read it to you. It says, over the last 12 years, Mr. Rogbeer's immigration case has undergone extensive judicial review at multiple levels of the nation's judicial system, including both immigration courts and the federal appeals court system. In each review, the courts have uniformly held that Mr. Rogbeer does not have a legal basis to remain in the United States. He's exhausted his petitions and appeals through the immigration courts, etc. He will remain in custody pending removal to Trinidad. That's the statement from ICE officials in response to this case. Amy, your response to that, and give me a sense of next steps here while your husband is still in detention in upstate New York.
So my response to that is they are not the legal counsel on this case. We have continued to say we have a valid legal claim against his deportation. We're working underlying things around the criminal conviction. There's a lot of pieces pending right now in the courts. And so to say that he's exhausted his remedies, that's just ICE's opinion. That's actually not fact, because he still has opportunity to continue trying. And unfortunately, it's difficult, but it doesn't mean it can't be done. And the court system is slow, and we know that well. And so we believe that we have a really strong chance of winning the current cases, but we need to have him here, and we need to have time to do that. I think, you know, the fact that they're detaining him also is just retaliatory and punitive. He's sitting in a county jail right now. It cost me, you know, over the last 4 days, I have spent over $200 in phone calls to be able to talk to my husband because of the phone systems out of the jails. You know, so next steps, there's a hearing coming up to challenge the legality of his detention alone, because even if they say that, you know, he's fully deportable and, you know, even if we lose all these cases, there's no reason that he needs to be detained. He's never been a flight risk, and he has absolutely never been a danger to anybody. And that should be the standard that we're looking at when we're locking people up, whether they're a flight risk, whether they're a danger. We don't get to just detain people in this country arbitrarily, and that is what they're doing. They're doing it to punish him.
And Ravi was rounded up in the first place because he showed up for a check-in with ICE officials.
Exactly.
Amy, we're going to have to run in just a minute, but before we do, Ravi is in detention in upstate New York. Have you been able to physically visit him? What has he described about the conditions of his detention?
I have physically visited him. He says it's cold. He says not the worst place he's been in, which I'm happy to know. But, you know, one basic fact, he can't get a glass of water when he's out of the common, when he's in the common area. So he's in a cell, and when he's in that cell, it has to be locked down. If he wants water, he has to go back to his cell and be locked in order to have a glass of water. So that, to me, is just one of the most dehumanizing things I've ever heard, that my husband, if he's out of his cell, which he can be, he can't get a glass of water. He can't make phone calls because they cost a fortune. You know, we're fortunate because I can pay for them. But, you know, think about other people who are locked up in that same facility who can't afford, you know, the 50 or 60 cents a minute it costs to call your family. You know, so is it the worst jail on the planet? Probably not. But, you know, he shouldn't be locked up at all.
Ravi Rogbeer is one of several immigrants' rights activists detained or deported by American officials in the last several months. Amy Gottlieb is Ravi's wife and an immigration activist herself. Amy, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
There was stunning testimony on Tuesday from a former Baltimore police detective as opening arguments began in the federal trial of two Baltimore detectives who were members of the corrupt undercover gun trace task force. They're accused of a long list of charges, including robbery, racketeering, collecting overtime hours not served, and a lot of other charges, too. Detectives Daniel Herschel and Marcus Taylor pleaded not guilty, but six other officers charged have already pled guilty, with several expected to testify for the prosecution. Brian Kubler is an investigative reporter for WABC affiliate WMAR-TV in Baltimore. He was in the courtroom as a former detective named Maurice Ward described shocking details behind this corrupt operation. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Todd.
There was some incredible testimony on Tuesday from Maurice Ward. What did he have to say?
For the press corps here in Baltimore that have been covering this trial and the Baltimore Police Department, we have been waiting for this trial because we have been trying to gather details of this case ever since it broke. The indictment came down on March 1st, 2017, and we were not let down. The first government witness was a former detective, Maurice Ward, that was part of this gun unit. He had pleaded guilty back in July and was part of the government's case. And as he was on the stand for the entire afternoon yesterday, the assistant U.S. attorney prodded him into basically telling the jury how this gun trace task force would work. We were able to learn some of their techniques called door pops or dope boy cars or sneak and peeks. These are all tactics this gun unit would use in order to shake down citizens and rob them and extort them. And we also heard more about how they were able to fraud the system and bilk overtime bills from the Baltimore City Police Department.
I mean, Maurice Ward talked about robbing homes, rolling up on people on the street, trying to get them to flee, illegal searches, planting guns on people. The list goes on. Flesh out some of the crazy details here.
Well, we heard the term door pops. Door pops apparently were a tactic where they would pull up aggressively on a group of people on the street, and they would pop open a door in order to see who would run. And then they would run after that person, they would tackle him, and then they would search him. The goal was always to get guns in this gun unit. It's always to get guns. And as long as they were producing, as they were high producers and taking guns off the streets, a lot of people would turn their heads. And so after that, they would get these guns, and they would then get drugs, and they would get money. A lot of times the drugs would go to the sergeant, in which he would then resell, and the money was then split up between all of the officers that were working that day. We also heard a term called dope boy cars, where the sergeant of the unit would say that Hondas and Acuras are usually driven by what he would call dope boys. And so they would pull them over for no reason at all other than the car they were driving, and they would search those cars in order to try and get guns and try and get drugs and try and get money. And the third technique that we learned about yesterday was called sneak and peeks, where they would gain entry into homes before they would get a warrant to see if there was anything in the house worth stealing. Then they would get the warrant and then come back and fill out a legitimate warrant for that search.
Brian, it's hard to wrap your head around the fact that we're talking about police officers. It's like something out of the movies. At one point, prosecutors took a hockey bag and dumped it out in the courtroom, and it was full of equipment that the cops were using.
It was quite a moment. Todd, I can tell you they pulled out two giant hockey bags full of equipment. And then the assistant U.S. attorney had Detective Ward come down off the stand and pull out things in the bag that he found familiar. He pulled out black Halloween masks. He pulled out black face masks, black clothing, black gloves. He said at one point they would try to dress as and hide their identities and call themselves federal officers in some raids. And then the other bag, as it hit the floor, it made a big metal clanking noise. And that's when the entire courtroom kind of stopped and was looking and listening. And at that point, they were pulling out heavy-duty crowbars, heavy-duty lock cutters they would use to gain entry into these houses to do their quote-unquote sneak and peeks. It was quite an incredible moment in court yesterday.
Brian, is there any indication that the stunning level of corruption and crime that six officers have already pled guilty to goes higher than just the Gun Trace Task Force to any leadership in the Baltimore police, or that anybody else knew about what was going on?
That is a question that we just simply don't know. The highest rank that pleaded guilty were two sergeants in this unit. One of them, Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, was the ringleader from what we can gather in most of the documents that we were able to receive and in a lot of the testimony yesterday. The four officers that are cooperating with the federal system and the prosecution here are all detectives. And so we don't know if those two sergeants that pleaded guilty are also working with the federal government. There have been rumors, but there's nothing to substantiate that this goes beyond this one rogue unit at this point.
People might remember we talked about it on this show several weeks ago, the death of former Detective Sean Souter, scheduled to testify in this trial. He wound up getting killed.
Yeah, 2017 was a bad year for Baltimore. The city had the worst murder rate it's had per capita ever recorded. As an exclamation point, on the end of that year was Detective Sean Souter's killing. That remains unsolved. And all that does is fuel a lot of theories out there in the city, none of which can anyone lay claim to that is true. All we know is that he was scheduled to testify in this case, the next day after his murder. But the FBI has said that it does not involve this case at all.
We talked a little bit about who knew what outside of this unit, but separately, some high-profile resignations among officials in Baltimore who were supposed to be helping to reform the Baltimore PD.
Yeah, that's a very recent development that happened on Tuesday evening. So the commissioner was fired on Friday by the mayor. Then on Tuesday, one of his deputy commissioners and then a chief were also resigned. Those two positions were key. in helping move this city along in the consent decree that it signed last year with the Department of Justice. And so there's an open question as to how that will affect that process under this new leadership.
So major unpredictability and chaos in the Baltimore Police Department, Brian, both in terms of the trial that we're talking about and broader reforms after the federal consent decree, sort of two separate tracks. After Maurice Ward's testimony in this trial of two police officers, what's next?
Well, it's going to be the cross-examination on Thursday. This trial takes a break on Wednesday, and it will resume again tomorrow. Detective Ward was on the stand the entire afternoon. The defense will now have a chance to cross-examine him as we open court on Thursday. And you have to understand there are two sets of defense attorneys because there are two defendants. And so, therefore, this could take a while. The judge says this could take 3 to 4 weeks. And after yesterday, it may take every bit of 3 to 4 weeks to complete this case.
Brian Kubler, investigative reporter with WMAR-TV in Baltimore. Brian, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thanks for having me.
We're now a year into the presidency of Donald Trump, and this week we're looking back at the real effects on American institutions and American people. We've looked at the economy, we've looked at the courts, and today, the environment. Coming into office, the president vowed to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords. It's a promise he followed through on over the summer.
So we could conceivably go back in, but I say this, we are very strong in the environment. I feel very strongly about the environment. Our EPA and our EPA commissioners are very, very powerful in the sense that they want to have clean water, clean air, but we also want businesses that can compete. And the Paris Accord really would have taken away our competitive edge.
1 year into the Trump administration, Kendra Pierre-Lewis is here, reporter for the Climate Desk at the New York Times. Kendra, thanks for being here.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Todd.
Kendra, the president says that he and his administration are strong on the environment. You heard it there. But after the first year of the Trump administration, what are the most important impacts the White House has had on environmental policy?
Yeah, I think the most important impacts that he's had is basically undermining sort of our place on the world stage in terms of climate leadership, not just with withdrawing with the Paris Climate Agreement, but also in terms of what we've done in terms of trying to roll back the Clean Power Plan. He's looking at rolling back emission standards for automobiles, and all of that sort of signals to the world that we are not taking climate change seriously.
So we need to talk about the EPA, and we will, but you reviewed 60 environmental rules government-wide that the Trump administration has promised to roll back through executive orders or rulemaking, other actions. What are some of the most notable?
So some of the most notable are the Clean Power Plan, reopening a review of fuel efficiency standards, delaying methane rules associated with like electric generation and with extraction of natural gas. There really isn't an area where they haven't touched. And just the other day, they issued a tariff on solar panels, which has tremendous effects on not just our ability to get off of carbon emissions, but on jobs. And sort of one of the things that I really want to bring up is like of the 60 rollbacks, it's mixed. Some of them would have happened regardless of the administration. It was time, like things getting delisted from the Endangered Species Act. But broadly speaking, the biggest rollbacks are the ones that are most under contention, that are the most risky, are the ones associated with climate change because we're running out of time.
Now, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, what does that agency look like now, about a year into the leadership of Administrator Scott Pruitt, a little bit less than a year after he was confirmed, compared to when President Trump took office?
So the EPA looks very different than it did under the Obama administration. There's a general sense that the EPA is using business interests first and interests of the American people sort of second in terms of water, in terms of air quality, and in terms of emission standards. They're anti-regulation. I think they're not completely trusting of science. And Pruitt is on the record as sort of being antagonistic to climate science in particular.
Climate and CO2. We played the president there withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accords, a major story. But on the domestic scene, you talked about the Clean Power Plan. You talked about methane, other rules that directly affect CO2 emissions or the government's ability to force companies to roll back on emissions.
I think it's really easy when you're talking about climate change to think of it as this very big and sort of nebulous issue. But if 2017 has made anything clear, it's sort of we're seeing the impacts of climate change already. It's not coming. It's here. All the experts say that we've already warmed 1 degree Celsius since pre-industrial levels. We need to be below 2 degrees Celsius in order to sort of stave off the worst effects of climate change, in order to really avoid disaster. In order to achieve that, we basically have to reduce emissions 40 to 70% by 2050, which is not that far away. And worldwide, emissions have to flatline by 2020. This last year, in 2017, emissions actually went up by 2%, which suggests that we're not at peak emissions yet. The other issue is that the United States by far leads the way per capita in emissions. And a lot of countries are using us as sort of an excuse to not lower their emissions because they're like, if we're unwilling to lower emissions, why should anybody else? And if we're unwilling to lower emissions, it almost doesn't matter what anybody else does.
Kendra Pierre Lewis, reporter with the New York Times. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's been 126 days since Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, and today, still, around a third of the island is without power. And many are blaming that slow and uneven recovery on PREPA, that's Puerto Rico's power utility. One side effect of Maria has been a lot of public debate on PREPA's history of mismanagement and corruption. Well, this week, Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rosselló, announced a plan to privatize PREPA, and not everyone is on board. Kate Aronoff joins me to explain all this. She's contributor to The Intercept and a writing fellow at In These Times, covering climate and American politics. Kate, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Kate, PREPA has been a troubled electrical utility for a long time, and there have been rumblings about a private takeover even before Maria. It seems like this wasn't a huge surprise to a lot of people.
No, for a lot of people, PREPA privatization has really been coming for a long time, and the narrative that I've been hearing from a lot of people on the island is that Hurricane Maria really provided Governor Rosselló, as well as potentially the Fiscal Control Board, which oversees the government of Puerto Rico's finances, with an excuse to finally pull the trigger on it.
Who's waiting in the wings? What kinds of companies are waiting to buy up here?
So that's a big question, because it wouldn't at face value look like an attractive investment to buy a sort of beleaguered utility that's $9 billion in debt.
I mean, it would be cheap.
It would be cheap. And so the actors that people are talking about are private equity firms, mostly, who have a history of sort of buying up coal plants and things and, you know, making money off them for a few years and then kind of selling them off. So where ratepayers actually fit into that, we don't know. And how a private equity company will run a utility, sort of, there are a lot of questions about. But I think we could see different actors emerge and, yeah, again, more questions than we really have answers to.
I mean,
right
we
now.
Learned a lot in the 2012 presidential campaign about private equity and how it operates because Governor Mitt Romney, who was the Republican nominee, had worked at Bain Capital. And the public learned a lot about how private equity firms can squeeze assets out of beleaguered companies. And that's legal. That's the way it works. This is a utility that has to operate over the long term. So the question is, will there be any rules to ensure that somebody doesn't come in, wring the assets out of PREPA such as they are, and then head for the hills?
As of now, it looks like no. It looks like that could be allowed to happen, essentially, especially if the Puerto Rican Energy Commission is annihilated, as it's set to be. And this is why groups like UTIER are really raising concerns, is that not just are they sort of at risk, are, you know, the unions that represent PREPA workers, not only do they stand to lose a lot, but actual ratepayers could just, you know, see whole parts of the island without power or without reliable service. And that's historically been one of the real benefits of PREPA, is that, you know, most Caribbean islands do not have the kind of electricity coverage that Puerto Rico has benefited from. And so that could really be called into question.
But Kate, what's the alternative here? A lot of people are very skeptical of privatization. I understand that. It is not as if PREPA is well-run, doing great, efficient, and doing its job to begin with. There is a very strong argument for drastic change.
Yeah, absolutely. And PREPA is not sort of a utility where if only it were better funded, it would operate functionally. It has historically been very corrupt, has been mismanaged for many years. And so funding is part of it. I think if there were sort of real concerted investment in making it a more resilient 21st century utility, that would be good. But also, the Puerto Rican Energy Commission was really put in place to think about what would it look like to transform PREPA. And virtually everyone is agreed that there should be some level of private investment. But in terms of selling whole parts of the utility off to unaccountable actors. I think that's something that people are understandably pretty wary of. But Puerto Rican Energy Commission was really created to make real sort of structural changes to PREPA. And of course, Governor Rosselló, when he took office, sort of scaled back a lot of the reforms that had been passed in the administration prior to rein in some of the corruption that had happened. So he got rid of, through special legislation, three, I think, consumer advocates who were there on PREPA's board really to look out for the interests of ratepayers. And so what PREPA has reverted to since he took office has been a sort of unaccountable system of a board run by political appointees who really don't have much of an idea of how to run an electric utility or experience doing that.
Kate Aronoff with The Intercept and In These Times reporting on PREPA in Puerto Rico. Kate, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Have a look now at how trafficking and the illegal sex trade impact communities all over the country. There are thousands of businesses in America that claim to be massage parlors, but in reality operate more like brothels. Women perform sex acts in the guise of massage and in many cases are underpaid, overworked, and abused. It's estimated that some 23,000 to 25,000 women work under these conditions, and the women are often victims of sex trafficking.
We're talking about a nearly $3 billion business across the United States, and pimps know that this is a business that is not cracked down upon in many states.
Philip Martin is senior investigative reporter at our partner station, WGBH, in Boston. And along with the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, Philip's been looking into the lucrative business of erotic massage parlors. These businesses are actually very easy to find. They often just take a simple Google search, but common internet technology and even legal loopholes have authorities constantly behind when trying to prosecute.
What you find are customers, just like you find Yelp, you find that these customer review sites are being used by hundreds of thousands of men in the United States. It's one of the most popular sites in the United States, one that's called RubMaps. And RubMaps is what Massachusetts Attorney General Mara Healey's office used that led to an investigation to alleged sex traffickers who ran an operation in the western part of the state in Hadley, but as well as in East Longmeadow and Framingham. Now, users of this site, RubMaps, run by a guy out of Cyprus, they see it as a comprehensive crowdsourced review site like Yelp. For my reporting, Todd, I talked with a successful local businessman who we'll call Michael. Now, he used to frequent these places to satisfy a habit. We've disguised his voice to protect his identity.
They had some reviews on there which specified locations, names of specific therapists, and what acts they would actually perform for you. So you can have a basic search, which would say, you know, pull up for me all of the massage places in Brighton or in Worcester.
And again, these are maps. They're like, for folks who are into the illicit massage business, it's like a treasure map. It tells you exactly where to go and what you can expect.
Philip, talk about the women who work in these illicit massage parlors and the exploitation that goes on through immigration channels and essentially the clandestine sex trade.
Well, Todd, what the Boston Police Department's human trafficking unit, what they've found is that many of the women found at illicit massage parlors in Massachusetts, they've traveled this well-worn path from Korea, from Thailand and China through Flushing, Queens. That seems to be a depot for human trafficking in this country. And they've traveled through Flushing, Queens here to the Bay State. Now, the illegal massage business can be the only option for some undocumented women from Asia. Many times they arrive at these places, their passports are taken away. And that's what happened to one of the women I interviewed. We'll call her Susan for the sake of this report. She ended up in brothels disguised as massage parlors up and down the East Coast, including New England. Here she is speaking through an interpreter.
At the time, I thought it was just massages and didn't think more about anything. And the boss basically told me I needed to give my passport to them, so I will not run away with their money.
Philip, if Susan has surrendered her passport and also, I'm sure, is very short on money, this quickly becomes a form of forced labor, indentured servitude.
It does, though it's also complex, I have to say, because we spoke to a fellow named John Chin, who is a researcher, and he has done research on massage parlors and massage parlor workers, quote-unquote workers, and found that some individuals do not regard themselves as victims of human trafficking. But again, he says it's difficult because in many cases, they have few other options, and many owe money to smugglers. And so many of those smugglers become traffickers because a debt is being paid off. So the whole issue of choice is very, very complex.
Well, what about the police here? I imagine they're far more interested in going after smugglers and traffickers than they are after individual women. Has it been difficult for them to prosecute?
Very difficult. And you hit the nail on the head. The notion of going after the women is becoming a passe form of prosecution. They're looking to try to prosecute the operators of these so-called massage parlors. So law enforcement officials, they can, again, they've found many of these suspected sex traffickers because of the proliferation of ad sites that advertise women, basically, in these massage places. But it's rarely led to prosecutions. As a result of my reporting, among those I spoke with was Lieutenant Donna Gavin, who heads up the Boston Police Anti-Trafficking Division. She says trying to shut down these places is like playing whack-a-mole. You shut down one, another opens up. Here's Lieutenant Gavin.
You can see the number of massage ads going up, it seems, like I said, on services with Backpage and Craigslist. I think it's a much larger network of probably organized crime. It's a big industry, and a lot of people are making a lot of money.
Philip, the police are fighting sophisticated networks of traffickers. They're fighting the internet. And they're also fighting, frankly, an industry that always has a healthy market. Do they see any solutions to this?
There are several proposals to try to crack down on illicit massage businesses. One is to basically close the loophole in Massachusetts. And this is true for other states, too, Todd. This loophole basically permits body works. And so illicit massage parlor owners essentially classify their business as body works. So there is legislation being proposed in Massachusetts. And by the way, it's been proposed before, but it's been opposed by individuals like a physical therapist, believe it or not, who are afraid that it would be too broad. But the idea is to close this loophole and to basically force licensing of body works in the same way that massage businesses are licensed. Another suggestion from the Attorney General's office is the old-fashioned crackdown on massage businesses, but in a more concerted fashion, a more systematic way. And of course, groups like Demand Abolition, an anti-human trafficking group out of Massachusetts, say the best thing to do is basically to educate and focus on the demand side of this industry, which of course are the men, people like Michael, who we heard earlier.
Philip Martin with WGBH in Boston. Philip, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
You can check out the series by Philip Martin and the New England Center for Investigative Reporting at thetakeaway.org.
The Supreme Court today handed down a historic decision on abortion.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. This week marks 45 years since the Roe v. Wade decision from the Supreme Court made abortion legal across the country. We've been covering where the abortion debate is in this country and where it may be going, and we've been hearing from you.
The choice of a woman's body comes when she chooses to have unprotected sex. That's when the choice is made, not after a baby is starting to be formed.
I worked at an abortion clinic for 5 years. I learned that the reasons for seeking our services were as varied as the women themselves.
I'm pro-life. However, I do believe that women should have a say in their lives.
I would not be a physician now had I not had that abortion. I respect their right to choose as well, but don't do it to me.
Your voices on the abortion debate in America. Abortion is legal in the United States, and so is protest. Women seeking legal abortions often face loud and sometimes aggressive protesters outside of family planning clinics. The Supreme Court ruled in 2014 that abortion protest is protected speech. The court allowed for buffer zones to separate protesters and patients in front of those clinics. But my next guest is on a mission to shine a light on clinic demonstrators. Wendy Kent is an artist and an activist, and for a time, she was an abortion clinic escort. Her ongoing project is called Faces of the Fight. It shows the intensity of abortion clinic protests, and part of her motivation is from her own experience as a teenager.
I was 14. Actually, I was 13 when I found out I was pregnant. I was 14 when I gave birth. I was in a pretty kind of unstable home environment. And a lot of people like to assume that my boyfriend at the time was a lot older or that, you know, something tragic happened. But in reality, we were just young, kind of ignorant, you know, teenagers.
Well, you went to a local clinic to seek counseling and to talk about abortion. What happened?
I had finally come to the realization that an abortion was definitely the best option for me, the smartest option. But I knew that there was some kind of something bad about it. Somehow had this in my mind that this was a negative thing or this was something to be embarrassed about or ashamed of. So when I went in, I kind of expected for this option to be kind of given to me or for someone to tell me that it was an option because I didn't want to have to ask. And that actually didn't happen. They asked me what I wanted to do, and I kind of suddenly said, you know, I think I want to have this baby, because honestly, I didn't know what else to say. And they said, okay, we'll get you some prenatal vitamins. And I was pretty dumbfounded, honestly.
You were 14 years old. You made the pronouncement that you wanted to keep your baby. Then what happened?
Well, I ended up giving birth, at 14. I was then in a pretty unstable environment. I was living with my mother and a stepfather, and I didn't feel safe. I didn't feel like it was a safe place for my daughter. So I looked back to her father's side of the family, and I asked them to come take her until I could find a more stable environment, a safer place to live. I left my mother's home, and I was on the streets after that. I was unable to find a place to go.
Well, Wendy, you described during your pregnancy the experience of going back to the clinic in your town to get prenatal care, to get vitamins, and being harassed on the street, I assume by protesters there. Can you talk about that experience? Because it had a lot to do with your later work as an artist.
I remember kind of feeling like I was in a tornado. I do very vividly remember someone spitting at my feet, and I was really confused. I didn't know who these people were, why they were there. I couldn't really understand why they were shouting or even what they were shouting.
Well, now that you're an adult, of course, you do understand why they're there, and you've traveled to many, many clinics throughout the East Coast and the Midwest. Taking photographs, documenting many of the protests that go on outside of abortion clinics as women try to enter and leave. What are you trying to show with your photos now? What do you want to say?
Just the truth, really. That's why I like photography. If you're doing it genuinely, then it tells the truth. And I think that the truth is that these are often very aggressive and intimidating people, and the tactics that they use are scary. They're invasive, and they're meant to shame women and really do nothing else.
Well, the protesters, of course, have a right to be on the line out there and protesting, according to the Supreme Court. What would you like protesters to see from your photographs if they look at them in the newspaper, or for other people to see who maybe aren't on hand day in and day out when these types of confrontations go on?
It's clearly a very frightening place for a person to be when you're showing up at a clinic expecting to be able to just walk in, access healthcare, and instead you show up and these photographs clearly show the opposite of what these people like to claim they're doing, which is caring for women. And really it just shows that they hope to control women and limit their access to healthcare.
Where would you like to see this debate go?
So I would really like to see these protesters realize, you know, what they actually look like. Hopefully these photographs will do that. I'd like for other people who identify as pro-life to recognize their neighbors and their, you know, family who are out doing this and try to really talk to them about why they think it's wrong, despite whatever their position is. And I'm really grateful that I've seen a lot of comments from pro-life people or anti-abortion people you know, in response to these photos that say things like, I'm pro-life, but I really don't approve of these tactics. And I think that we need more people like that speaking out against this harassment.
Wendy Kent, artist, photojournalist, and activist, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You can see some of Wendy Kent's photos and get more of her story by heading to our website at thetakeaway.org. Well, if you've been listening to this show for a while, you might know that we love sci-fi and speculative fiction on The Takeaway. Well, yesterday we lost a great. Ursula K. Le Guin has died at age 88. Le Guin actually didn't like being typecast as a sci-fi writer. She told the New York Times last year, I don't want to be reduced to being the sci-fi writer. People are always trying to push me off the literary scene. To hell with it. And it's partly from her influence that science fiction has a stronger, more well-respected place in literature today. Le Guin's ideas were fascinating. Her writing was exquisite. Here she is on WNYC back in 2004, reading from her essay, A Non-Euclidean View of California as a Cold Place to Be, about a different kind of utopia.
Utopia has been yang. In one way or another, from Plato on, utopia has been the big yang motorcycle trip. Bright, dry, clear, strong, firm, active, aggressive, lineal, progressive, creative, expanding, advancing, and hot. What would a yin utopia be? It would be dark, wet, obscure, weak, yielding, passive, participatory, circular, cyclical, peaceful, nurturant, retreating, contracting, and cold.
Listen to Ursula K. Le Guin there and place yourself inside some of your favorite sci-fi, and you'll know that in many ways she was the godmother of the genre. Do you have a favorite work or a quote from Ursula K. Le Guin? You can share it with us at The Takeaway on Twitter. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.